one or two more follow-ups then. What was the sense among the three of you talking there about the implications that where the CIA was concerned, there were a lot of things no one seemed to know?
As I recall that meeting, my office had just been moved from the office of the Secretary of Defense into the Joint Chiefs of Staff structure, which is a very formal structure. At that time, it was legally controlled at 400 officers, and even to move my small office down there, they had to increase the congressional approval of the more than 400 limit on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So it was an important move when they made it. Now, although I may have joked a little bit about the generals not knowing that such an enormous organization existed around the world in our support of CIA, they were very serious about it. They felt that it was a real oversight to have this sort of thing going on without review. And I'm of the opinion that this is one of the real reasons why the Joint Chiefs of Staff and Mr. McNamara had agreed to establish this Office of Special Operations within the Joint Chiefs of Staff, so that all the military forces would be treated equally in their supporting activities in the CIA, and so that the chairman would always be briefed on what was going on in covert work. And in the support of covert work, which goes on every day, the covert operation might be 10 days, but we're supporting them year-round. It was a serious business, and they recognized it as such.
You write further on that by the time of the Bay of Pigs operation, the CIA was part of a greater team which used the agency and other parts of the government to carry out almost any secret operation it wanted. By that time, this organization had the equipment, the facilities, the men, and the funds to carry out clandestine operations that were so vast that even on the basis of simple definition, they were no longer truly secret, nor could anyone hope that they might be. The availability of supplies and facilities made it possible for all of this to come about. The growth of the CIA and of the greater secret team has resulted more from the huge success of the Deputy Director of Support side of the agency than from either the Deputy Director of Plans or the Deputy Director of Intelligence. Please comment on the importance you ascribe to this Deputy Director of Support side of the agency.
Well, it's one thing to have an approval to carry out a covert operation and then to be able to go to the Defense Department or any other part of the government and get support for that operation. It's a completely other thing to have warehouses full of equipment, ships, aircraft, and people all over the world, and be able to carry on covert operation in a regular basis. And by you've used a good point of reference, the Bay of Pigs. By 1960, when President Eisenhower approved the early actions that later led to the Bay of Pigs, and these were very, very small matters, the agency was able itself to schedule a program that they knew was going to be a major program. Any of us in covert operation knows that 3,000 men in a program that led to putting, what was it, 1,200, 1,300 on a beach in a foreign country is not covert. You can't train 3,000 men in Guatemala, Nicaragua, some unfortunately in Mexico by inadvertence, and operate radio stations off islands in the Caribbean, et cetera, and call it covert. It's just a joke. The New York Times was reporting on the program almost daily. Castro was broadcasting about its threat almost daily, and yet it was called a covert program. The thing that was against being covert was its size. But, be that as may, the CIA had the aircraft. They had the B-26s. In fact, we, as I think I said sometime earlier, we had created for the Cuban exiles an air force, a tactical combat air force that was larger than any air force in Latin America at the time. And that came from CIA assets. That was their aircraft. There were planes that were used in the Indonesia business. They took planes back from the Vietnam theater. They used a lot of C-54s that Air America had put together. As a matter of fact, it's very interesting what they did do. They even brought Philippine Army officers who had worked with General Lansdale in the Magsaysay campaign in the Philippines back in the 50s. They even brought some of those officers into Guatemala to do the training there. See, they had the facilities that were worldwide and involving people even from other governments. So this is what they had gotten into existence in time to run something like this anti-Castro program. Yet, when it started, the first request the agency made to the Department of Defense when they got the approval from Eisenhower to start this anti-Castro move was for 2 Navy doctors. That's all they needed. They said, we need 2 Navy doctors. The Navy did not want to give up 2 doctors at that time. They didn't have 2 that they could do it because it was a long-term, indeterminate period. So the CIA men came to my office and they said, could we get 2 Air Force doctors? Most of our doctors were flight surgeons. We did not want to give them up. But I talked to the chief surgeon in the Air Force, and he had a few doctors at that time, I think at Lackland Air Base in Texas, that would be willing to do this on a voluntary basis and that he could spare. So it happened that we sent 2 Air Force doctors to begin the program. That is all it was. They didn't ask for anything else. Here's the anti-Castro program beginning, and they wanted 2 doctors. Of course, we asked them why. The reason was that they were going to put hundreds of Cuban exile men who were enrolled in the Army at a small military base that belonged to the U.S., was used by the U.S. in Panama. And they needed doctors because the men would be in the base in Panama. They didn't ask us for equipment. They didn't ask for airplanes and rifles and all, trucks and everything. They had that. So they could, just by filling in with a few things they didn't have, they were ready to go. And they were ready to go more than we thought. They had a lot of capability. Within a month or so, they were building a big air base over near Retalaleo in Guatemala. And they did this themselves, bulldozers and every other darn thing, and of course with their money they bought for the construction. So by the time of the 1960s, the agency could run major operations, major warfare, you might call it, by themselves. Well, this led to an interesting bit of political development, because during the summer of 60, we were using primarily a World War II aircraft, transport aircraft called a C-46, carry 40 or 50 people, or carry a pretty good sized cargo. We'd fly it from Guatemala or Nicaragua to Cuba. We would not fly it from the United States. We didn't want any reference to the United States. They still thought they were playing a covert game. And we'd make airdrops in Cuba. Well, this was a kind of a touch-and-go game, and many of the airdrops just disappeared. They didn't drop to the right people, or Castro found out about it and intercepted it for him. But in any case, that's what they were doing, small airdrops, and mostly of equipment, weapons, communications gear, to what they thought were people on the ground who would handle it in the anti-Castro movement. Well, that went on until the political campaign of 1960, and it was pretty active. And the most active person on this from the administration side was Richard Nixon. And he was running for president and against Kennedy. In the very close election, when Kennedy won, within a week, the agency came in and told us that they were planning for a force of 3,000 Cuban exiles, and that their target would be an invasion of Cuba. Well, this was something they developed themselves. I know very well from the repeated dealings we had with the White House from March of 60 until November of 60, that President Eisenhower never, never authorized an invasion of Cuba. But the agency, able to plan for that themselves, and realizing Eisenhower was in a lame duck position after the election, and that Kennedy, although he knew about this training program, had no idea what the limitations put on it were, would probably accept this kind of thing, they just moved it from small airdrop things or over the beach. We put a lot of teams over the beach from pontoon raft equipment and that kind of thing. And the next thing you know, we're in this big program. so that when Alan Dulles and Richard Bissell brief Kennedy, I think in the end of November or December of 60, down at Kennedy's home in Palm Beach, they were talking of a 3,000-man force, not these little intermittent airdrops. I think there's two things here, though, that the agency wasn't aware of. Kennedy knew the Cuban leaders. One of Kennedy's close friends was Senator Smathers of Florida. Senator Smathers had connections with all the Cuban people in Florida, and I think he had briefed Kennedy. Because in an interesting little event, I was asked one day to go from the Pentagon to the Senate office building to Senator Kennedy's office and to take a car that could carry six people, the driver, myself, and four passengers. So I went over to the Senate office building, went into Kennedy's office, and I sat there for a few minutes, and the senator came out and shaking hands goodbye to four men who were Cubans. I could tell by their Spanish accent, tell by the names that Kennedy called them, and they seemed like old friends. Kennedy was patting one of them on the back and, well, I'll see what we can do for you and all that sort of thing. And then the senator turned to me and he said, the Secretary of Defense wants to meet these people. You please take them back to the Pentagon to see the Secretary of Defense. Well, those four men, one of them was Manuel Artima. Artima was the commanding officer on the beach of the brigade in Cuba. Kennedy knew Artima, and he had talked with Artima. He knew what Artima's plans were. The other man, Mendonca, was one of a former, I believe, former president of Cuba for a short time. There was a man named De Verona, who was one of the leaders of the Cuban exile group, and I can't recall the fourth man, but that's the type of people they were. They were the top people that Alan Dulles had put together for the Cuban exile group, and here was Kennedy meeting them privately in his own office. He knew them ahead of time. So the people that think Kennedy didn't know what was going on don't understand how much experience Kennedy had with this kind of thing.
When do you think that meeting really was?
This took place in August of 1960. And in fact, I can tell you how we can pin the date down. There's no question about it. Artima had just come from addressing the annual American Legion Convention in Detroit that year, which I believe was in August of 1960. So these things were happening, one right on top of the other, you see. But the most important thing was that later on people were saying, well, Nixon knew all about this brigade going into Cuba, but Kennedy didn't know about it. Kennedy did. Yeah. He was smart. He kept it quiet. Well, as this force developed, by January of 1961, just before the inaugural, the agency was making regular plans for an invasion on the beach. And they brought in a Marine colonel named Jack Hawkins to head the tactical situation, to make the plans for it. And it was a very good plan. I think I mentioned earlier, they decided that the absolute fundament of the plan was to wipe out all Castro's combat aircraft, which meant the CIA was going to use their own aircraft, which had the combat capability. These were these B-26s that had been developed for the Indonesian campaign, and use them in air battles, go right over Cuba and destroy Castro's air force before they ever invaded the beach. This was a key to that program. Well, I'll go that far with this story because I don't think we're supposed to be talking about the Bay of Pigs. But you see, they could do these things themselves. Even the beginning of combat in Laos and combat in Vietnam were done with equipment that the agency owned by the period of 1960-61. It was a major combat force by that time.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, from your own experiences, that Alan Dulles knew back in the late 40s, or at least by the time he wrote the Dulles-Jackson Career Report, how important this component of the CIA would be?
You mean to develop the its own? Well, of course, the thing that Mr. Dulles realized, and we must not downplay the ability of Jackson, who was actually deputy director of the CIA for years too, a very knowledgeable man, and Matthias Correa. They realized that a covert operation require materiel, and they also realize that if you don't have your own, you can't make your plans yourself. Having to make plans with borrowed equipment is always rather difficult. So you can see that in this, really, the reason I go back to this Jackson, Correa, Dulles document so often, and I think why I called it the Dulles Mein Kampf, was this was the plan of the future of CIA. There's no question about that. And it was based upon having the ability to do it, the bases, the people, the airplanes, the ships, everything else.